offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and as always, having the pleasure of joining all of you on this beautiful evening from our studios at Prashanti Nilayam. In this program, we go through the Bhagavad Gita in as much detail as possible, and it has always been my pleasure, and I've said this before, I might say it as many times more, that if not for this opportunity to share all of this with all of you, I don't think I myself would have had the time and interest to go through the Bhagavad Gita in such detail. It has nothing got to do with how glorious this text is, but I think the importance that we give to it depends on various things, and for me, this opportunity of talking to all of you on the Gita has given this opportunity to study it. And as I've said many times before, I am not learned in this text. I'm not an expert in this text. Even as I am going through the text, I am actually sharing it with you, and that's why it is so much more a pleasure. And there are a lot of people out there, I'm sure, who are way more qualified to speak on the Gita, to explain these verses. So it is not that there is an expert sitting on this side of the mic and speaking to all of you. As much as you all are learners, so am I, and that's why this is a pilgrimage that we are doing together, and it is our prayer to Swami that even as we go through these verses, at least something gets into us, something becomes a part of our daily practice. I think that should be the fundamental prayer. We are about to complete the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and the fifth chapter is referred to as the Sannyasa Yoga. And even as I was thinking about it today, I was thinking how wonderful it would be if we say, yes, I've finished Sannyasa Yoga, so I've understood Sannyasa completely. And unfortunately, the spiritual concepts are not like that. It's not that you have finished studying it and you have acquired it. It needs a lifetime of practice. And so even as we go through these verses, even as we constantly contemplate on them, let's hope, as we always say, the Nididhyasanam happens. We are doing the Shravanam. We should do the Mananam. And we just hope that with Swami's blessings, the Nididhyasanam also happens. As I said, we are in the fag end of the fifth chapter. We'll be completing it this week. We'll begin with a short summary of what we covered last week. We went through verses 23, 24 and 25 last week. In the 23rd verse, Krishna speaks of a very particular spiritual exercise. It's a very specific exercise, and also it's a very practical exercise. He speaks of not merely controlling desires and realizing the self. Those are in the realm of more subtle processes. He speaks of controlling the force that is born of desire and anger. He speaks of kama krododbhavam vegam. He says that whoever is able to deal with this will be able to attain the ultimate in this very earthly plane of existence itself. And we further discussed about what is this control that Krishna is speaking of, and also the most important point of how to identify those desires that create a force on us to act, right? These were the things that we saw in regard to this particular shloka. And verse number 24 was another beautiful shloka from the point of view of the way it was structured, because it had a beautiful play of words with one particular word, and that is antaha, which means within. Krishna stated that one who is a antasukha, whose happiness lies within, antararamaha, one who revels in that which is within, antarjyotihi, who is illumined by what is within alone, such a person is a yogi who attains Brahma Nirvana. And then in the 25th verse, Krishna mentions a few more qualities, and some of them are kshina kalmashaha, the flaws of kama and krodha, or the vegam born out of kama and krodha have been removed. Along with that, raga and dvesha have also been completely destroyed, and that's why kshina kalmashaha, completely removed any kind of flaw. So one external flaw is that force which is born out of kama and krodha, but the internal flaw, which is the fundamental cause for that, is raga and dvesha. So when he says kshina kalmashaha, it means one who has cleanse the mind completely of raga, dvesha and kama and krodha. Then he says, chinna dvaidha, even the basic delusion of duality has also been completely torn apart. That's the meaning of the word chinna. Chinna dvaidha. The duality has been torn apart in this person. And then he says, yatatmanaha, someone who is in control of oneself. And then comes a very beautiful statement, sarva bhuta hite rataha, one who finds delight in the welfare of all beings. In fact, I would like to spend a few more minutes on this particular shloka by way of summary, but also because I don't want to miss out not having emphasized enough the statement that Krishna is making in this particular last shloka. Right in the beginning of the Gita, when the discourse started, we spoke about sorrow itself in general and how this whole discourse is in a way in response to Arjuna's vishadha or despondency. Also, Arjuna himself at one point he says that I will do, Krishna, as whatever you say, but please accept me as your disciple and explain. And deep within the idea that he was conveying was that there is a good chance that I might still be sad after doing what you say. I might win the battle, I might perform my task, I might accomplish my dharma, but there is a chance that I might still be sad at the end of all this. So I would like to understand why I am being told to do what I am being told to do. Right? So that is why that sorrow is a very important component in Bhagavad Gita itself. So in that sense, the entire Gita is, or for that matter, even entire Vedanta is to take us beyond the state of sorrow. That is why the jnani is repeatedly described as someone who has attained that happiness which is inexhaustible. Sukham akshayam is one of the words that Krishna used a couple of verses ago, which means that person is no more likely to become sad again. Now, what happens to that person when he or she sees pain in others around? He or she doesn't suffer because of jnana, but what is the jnani's response when someone around who is still yet to attain that same wisdom is suffering? I think that is being referred to in this particular shloka. Krishna describes the jnani as chinna dvaidha, yatatmanaha sarvabhuta hite rataha. As I just explained, chinna dvaidha means is the highest state of wisdom where the duality has been completely destroyed in the individual. But at the same time, the person is sarvabhuta hite rataha, wishes for the welfare of all beings. We tend to see this in a lot of people with half-baked wisdom, right? The moment we read a little bit of Advaita along with the understandable disregard for our own pain, we kind of develop a disregard for others' pain as well. And this, I think, is definitely not a sign of spiritual maturity. That is why in one statement, Krishna makes both these points, saying that yes, the jnani has destroyed all Dvaita Bhava, which means there is no delusion whatsoever. He is wisdom itself, but he still has sympathy, right? He still has care for others' happiness as they understand it, right? He understands that this is all delusion and all of whatsoever. But at the same time, he wishes for everyone's happiness in the level they are in, right? That's a very important point, in my opinion. I thought I should take some time to stress upon that. Maybe the best example for that in the Gita is Lord Krishna himself. He is wisdom itself, right? In one of the shlokas, we saw that Krishna is wisdom itself. But he still has sympathy for Arjuna's plight. And he's patiently explaining the entire concept of karma yoga to Arjuna. It did appear like Krishna was mocking at Arjuna briefly, right? In the beginning of the second chapter. But we saw the reason behind that. Swami very beautifully described in the Gita Vahini about that. But Krishna's compassion is so evident in all this. Just like how Swami's compassion towards us was so evident in the way he patiently nurtured us. Right? Swami also mocked at our pain once in a while, I think. When in that sense of what Krishna was doing to Arjuna, right? But he did not mock at our pain by saying that you're such low in your understanding. That was never Swami's approach. When we were students, we've seen on many occasions when devotees would come to Swami after a period of grief, having lost a loved one or after having a disaster in the family. We've seen Swami's students who have lost their parents when they were still studying in Swami's university. And at such moments, we've seen Swami's response. With what compassion and tenderness Swami would deal with such grief. Can any of us claim to have more wisdom than Swami? I think that is something that we must keep in mind. Yes, Swami would instruct them on why they should not cry, and then the body is not eternal, and everybody who is born has to die, and all of this wisdom, the higher wisdom in the council would be there, right? But never would Swami mock or belittle their pain, right? I recall when one very long-time devotee had come to Swami in immense grief. This is a devotee who has been coming to Swami from the 50s or 60s, if I'm not wrong. And again, I'm not sure whether it was his daughter or daughter-in-law. She had passed away while giving birth to her second child, right? And it was a very, very tough moment for the family because she left behind this just-born child. And she also had another child which was about 2 years old, and the mother was not there for that family. So that family was absolutely devastated. And all through that, they came to Swami. I mean, they came to Parthi, the entire family. But all through that period, Swami was giving instructions to that family through one of the family members who happened to be a student of Swami and who was in Swami's institution at that point in time. So Swami was not directly speaking to that senior devotee and his wife who were the ones who really needed that counsel and solace from Swami, right? But Swami was giving them all this necessary guidance and even the solace that they were seeking, but Swami was doing this through another family member and not to them directly. But eventually, after a few days, Swami called the whole family for an interview, and Swami calmed them and counseled them personally. At that time, Swami said, "See, you were so disturbed those few days that you will be in no state of mind to listen to Swami's counsel." Right? What Swami was going to say is the purest counsel a person in grief can have, but when we are so lost in that grief, probably we are not in a state of mind to receive even wisdom, right? So Swami gave them that space, Swami gave them that sympathy that they required, allowed them to grieve because he knew that, you know, that whatever state of mind they were in, they needed that space to grieve. And after that, you know, Swami called them and Swami gave them love and counseled them. And that was the time probably they would have been able to see beyond their depression and the wisdom in Swami's words. So this is a very important trait of a person of wisdom, and I thought I should stress on this point, and it is very critical. Because without sensitivity, there can be no maturity or no wisdom. So if reading a few books on Vedanta and listening to a few talks is making us insensitive to others' pains, I would say we only need to read more. We need to contemplate more and we need to do more sadhana. Because all wisdom can only make us more sensitive, more loving, should make us a sarvabhuta hite rataha. This very beautiful quote by Alexander Pope, which I would love to quote in this context. It is so apt for what we are discussing here. He says in one of his poems, "A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pierian spring. There shallow draughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again." Very, very beautiful quote. He says the Pierian spring is actually a mythological spring of learning and wisdom. So he says when you drink knowledge, shallow draughts or taking small sips will intoxicate the brain, which means that it renders you in a state which is not useful to you or anybody else. But drinking largely sobers the mind. So very beautifully put, right? Little knowledge of Vedanta can make us arrogant and even disdainful towards pain. But when we are truly wise, we will be a sarvabhuta hite rataha, one who wishes for others' welfare in the state of understanding they are in, right? At the same time, we will strive to raise their understanding also when one has the opportunity, but never to mock at somebody's pain just because we have understood that we are not the body or any that sort of a wisdom, right? So I think that verse was very important for that point, that in one statement Krishna puts both these, that a jnani is somebody who has destroyed his duality, but at the same time he had that kind of compassion and sympathy. So that was the 25th verse with a slightly long summary, but I thought it was necessary. We'll now go to the 26th verse. We have 4 more verses to complete, so I think we'll have enough time to do that. So we will go to verse number 26 of the 5th chapter. It is beautifully rendered in clear voice by Brother Shyam. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning after that, and then we will discuss in detail.
Kāma-krodha-vimuktānām yatīnām yata-cetasām abhito brahma-nirvānam vartate viditātmanām.
To the monks who have control over their internal organ, who are free from desire and anger, who have known the self, there is absorption in Brahman either way. So that is the 26th verse of the 5th chapter. In the past few shlokas, there is one thing that is quite evident from what Krishna is saying. Though the spiritual quest is about using our life, this time on earth, and the opportunity as a human being to attain something that is much larger than life itself, much larger than what the world can offer us, there is still value in a certain achievement that we can attain within this world, within this lifetime. In other words, there is a mention of two types of achievements. One is the achievement that is got after this life ends, that is, one doesn't have to repeat this life and death cycle. The sadhaka becomes a jnani, there is no ego and hence no karma to work out, so he doesn't have to come back again. The other is the achievement in this plane of existence itself. The happiness one finds. The relative peace compared to the worldly person, and as we saw in the previous verse, one becoming a better human being in general. And there were a few shlokas in the previous chapter too where Krishna made it very clear that karma yoga and its benefits, or for that matter, even any kind of sadhana is not meant for some afterlife alone, right? So, because that is again a problem. If we are going to do everything in this world only for something that is going to be rewarded after life, that can also be a very wrong approach to sadhana and everything. So there is something that is to be won in this life. It is also the best approach in this life that we are leading itself. And I think this is something that we must keep in mind. We are not being urged to live completely miserable and compromised lives here so that we can go to the heavens and enjoy. That is not the concept which Vedanta speaks about. And that would definitely be a gross misrepresentation if we were to consider it that way. Maybe we are likely to come to such conclusions, and that is why every now and then Krishna is reiterating that karma yoga is for a better life here as well, and as to ensure that we are not also to ensure that we don't keep coming back again and again, so that we put a break to this birth and death cycle. And I think it's quite natural that some of us might be not so interested with the idea of not coming back or the idea of moksha itself. Honestly speaking, the concept of moksha is still a concept, right? We don't know really what happens. We're not sure of that idea. What is it which will happen? What will be the experience when we become moksha? Because the thing is, everything that we experience in this life as we are living today is being experienced through this ego, and this ego operating through the mind and the body. Almost everything, other than, as Swami would say, the state of deep sleep, right? That's the only place where the ego is not there and we are able to experience it. Otherwise, every experience in this world is experienced through the ego. So we have no idea what is it going to feel like when the ego is completely removed, right? So that is why moksha is still a concept for many of us, and we don't really have a sure idea of what it is. But we all want to be happy. We all want to be happy here and now, isn't it? We all would like to have better control over our own lives and would like to have, in a manner, security for our peace and the security for our happiness. So even if we forget about the highest goal of life and concentrate on how to live better lives here, in a way we will be better off turning to karma yoga. So in this shloka also Krishna clearly states that the jnani finds brahma nirvanam either way. Abhito brahma nirvanam vartate. Abhitaha means in all sides, right? That's the actual meaning of the word. But it is also interpreted as on both sides. Ubhayataha, as Adi Shankara would put it in his commentary. Abhitaha means all sides, but it can also be translated as two sides, because the reference point here is death. And when we are speaking about Brahma Nirvana on either side, it means on either side of death, which means Brahma Nirvana after one passes away, Brahma Nirvana even while one is alive, right? It is Jivan Mukta is somebody who is liberated even when one is alive, right? And as I had mentioned the last week, the combination of karma and krodha play a very important role in much of the explanations that is given in the Gita. In the 23rd verse, Krishna had said, kama krododbhavam vegam sa yuktaha sa sukhi naraha. Right? He who is able to rein in the force born out of karma and krodha will be a happy man, right? He will be happy now. And in this shloka again, a reference is made to such an individual who has started by handling the forces born of karma and krodha, but has eventually managed to deal with karma and krodha itself. Kama krodha vyuktanam. Of those who are free from desire and anger. The word yukta was used to describe one who is ever focused or attached to the Atman, right? So vyukta is the antonym of that, which means one who is not pulled in by that or not attached to that, one who is detached. So kama krodha vyukta means being detached from kama and krodha. Then Krishna goes on to say, yati nam yata chetasam, yati nam yata chetasam. In the previous shloka, Krishna had said, yatatmanaha, someone who is in control of oneself. The word yati means to control. So as a noun, a yati is a person of self-control. So the word yati also means to make efforts, right? That is the root word for, even in Telugu we use the word yatna. Yatna prayatnamu, Swami would say. Yatna means to make efforts. So yati also means to make efforts. So in that sense, if you look at this word, yati nam yata chetasam, can be described as a person who has made efforts and has become one who has controlled one's own mind. Yati nam yata chetasam. Chetasaha means the mind. So yati nam, one who has made the effort, yata chetasam, to control the mind and has become the master of the mind. So this is a reference to a sadhaka or a mumukshu who is focused and hence makes efforts to control the mind, right? Sometimes this shloka can be misinterpreted as the word yati is also used for an ascetic, right? But clearly it is not given that Krishna is, it's clearly understood this in all these chapters Krishna is speaking about the karma yogi, and he's trying to convince Arjuna to become a karma yogi, right? He's talking about that kind of effort. So yati nam yata chetasam is a karma yogi who has with his own or her own effort has controlled the antakarnas or the inner instrumentalities of the mind. Then he goes on to say, viditatmanam, the one who has come to know oneself or the truth of oneself. Viditatmanam. Then he says, Abhito Brahma Nirvanam Vartate. He's absorbed in Brahma Nirvana on either side. Right? That's the phrase that we had already seen. But of course, if we were to see what these words literally mean, Abhito, I said, it could be translated as both sides. But Abhito Brahma Nirvanam Vartate, in a literal sense, can be translated as there is liberation for this person all around. Right? On all sides. This is again a suggestion that the liberation is there for the taking for such a person, right? In the second, third chapters, Krishna was saying that once you do this, then the liberation is just there. It's just a matter of time before you reach that state. So this whole portion is about a true sannyasi, not a sannyasi who has chosen to wear an ochre and go away to the forest. Yes, he is also included in this definition of a sannyasi, but we are talking about a sannyasi who has come to renounce doership. So it could be a karma yogi or it could be a sannyasi or monk. It doesn't matter. Anybody who has come to renounce doership. And Krishna had said, for such a person, there is no difference between the path of Sankhya and karma yoga. So one other way of explaining this shloka is a yati. That is a spiritual aspirant who is sincere. Kama krodha viyuktat, viyuktanam, sorry. One who is sincere and who has given up desire and anger, kama and krodha, yatachetasam, who has completely controlled the mind, viditatmanam, who has known the truth of oneself, abhito brahma nirvanam vartate. For such a person, liberation is there on any side or any path that he or she chooses. The person may choose to become a sannyasa or choose to continue in karma yoga. It doesn't matter. Brahma nirvanam is guaranteed because it is there on all sides. Whichever direction this person chooses to move forward, there Brahma nirvanam can be found. Right? That is one more beautiful way of looking at this statement, abhito brahma nirvanam vartate. So in a way, this is also a very apt translation given to the entire chapter that began with Krishna saying how both pathways are equally worthy and can lead to the goal, right? Given that this is the fag end of the chapter, this verse, if translated this way, gives us that understanding that Krishna is saying that, see, these are the prerequisites. You have to give up your doership. These are the way you have to do it. This is the way you'll have to deal with your mind, and this is how you have to do your actions. And at the end of it, it doesn't matter what choice you make. I want to go away to the forest. I want to become a sannyasi. I want to go and settle in an ashram. All of that doesn't matter because there is liberation in every step or any direction this person may choose to take. Right? So that is the 26th verse of the 5th chapter. Now we'll go to the next verse. In fact, 27 and 28 are one complete sentence, though they can be translated separately too. So we'll listen to 27 and 28 together, and that'll be more perfect to translate also. It'll be like one statement that we'll be able to translate. And then we will discuss in detail about its meaning.
Sparshan Kritva Bahir Bahyam Chakshuschaivantare Bhruvoho Pranapanau Samau Kritva Nasabhyantaracharinau Yatendriyamano Buddhihi Munirmoksha parayanaha vigatecha bhayakrodho yasada mukta evasaha.
Keeping the external objects outside, the eyes at the juncture of the eyebrows, and making rhythmic the outgoing and incoming breaths that move through the nostrils, the contemplative who has control over his organs, mind and intellect should be fully intent on liberation and free from desire, fear and anger. He who is ever is verily free. So this is the 27th and the 28th verse. The description given here of the person for whom liberation is available all around, or for whom nirvana is so accessible, continues in these shlokas, and there are some very specific descriptions given here. But these shlokas are slightly different from the previous ones for a certain reason. In the process of talking about karma yoga, Krishna drops a few hints about some very specific spiritual practices or sadhanas. In fact, to be more specific, Krishna is speaking of some standard meditation exercises which can help the sadhaka. And that is why these shlokas are important for study in that sense. In fact, the next chapter is going to be all about meditation. So this is in that sense a precursor for that. Now, Krishna has sufficiently described the jnani as someone who has nothing to do with the attractions the outside world has to offer. In fact, a few shlokas back, in the 21st shloka, he had said, and he had described a jnani as bahya sparsheshu asaktatma, one who is completely detached with the objects of the senses that are outside. Right? In the case of a jnani, he or she is perfectly happy with self, with the self within. That is why the jnani was described as antasukha antararamaha, one whose happiness is only within and who only revels in the self within. But as sadhakas, we are not yet there. But even for sadhana, it is important to turn away from the distractions of the sense objects every now and then, at least for a few minutes or an extended time during the sadhana that we perform. In fact, that is the very idea of whatever we do as sadhana, be it meditation, fasting, or we taking up some form of what we refer to as diksha and going on a pilgrimage. It is a means by which we are trying to communicate to our own mind that the pleasures from the senses alone are not the purpose of this life. I am looking for something higher than this happiness that is related to sensual pleasures. But then the question comes, what am I to do with the senses? When I'm turning it away, what am I to do with them? And that is a practical question, really. And there are some practices for that in yoga and meditation. And Krishna is making a very general and very, slight hint reference to few of them in this particular shloka. He says, Bahyan Sparshan, the external sense objects, the same phrase that Krishna had used in the 21st shloka to refer to them. Bahyan sparshan, the external sense objects. Kritva bahihi, shutting them out. Right? So that is the command Krishna is giving. The external sense objects, let them be left outside. The senses are like windows through which the external world enters our internal world, right? We have heard Krishna speak about this in detail in the second chapter. We interact with the world through the sense objects. Then we begin to contemplate on what was seen, heard or felt. And then that leads to attachment, right? It further leads to the pair of kama and krodha. In fact, the shloka where Krishna mentioned this is Dhyayate Vishayan Pumsaha Sangaste Shupajayate Sangat Sanjayate Kamaha Kamat Krodod Krodha Abhijayate. So Krishna is saying that this is what happens when you interact, when your inner world interacts with the outer world. So Krishna is saying sometimes it is better to withdraw yourself from the external senses and allow the external objects to be outside. Don't let them enter your inner self. Sparshan kritva bahir bahyan. It is like saying what is outside, let it remain outside. Don't bring it in. Because once it comes in, dhyayate vishan pumsa, you start contemplating about it, you get attached to it, and then it starts agitating you, whether you have it or you don't have it. Now when we are speaking about the senses, they are not just the organs, right? we've spoken about this. The sense organs are still a part of the physical body. The eye, the physical eye, the physical ear, the physical ear with all its components, you know, your middle ear and your eardrum and everything, right? They're all still part of the physical body, which is made of the five elements, right? And that is why Swami would often use this word for the physical eye, charma chakshu. Charma means leather, right? So the charma chakshu means the plain eye. It is still a part of the physical body. But when we say the senses, it is the physical organ plus the mental function that goes with that organ. And that is how they connect the physical to the mental, the external to the internal. So when I say my eye is this, when you look at me, you can see my eye. It has a retina, it has this pupil and all of that. And that is still part of the body. And when I look at any object outside, that which processes this image and that which makes it either a pleasant image or unpleasant image or causes fear in me, all of that happens through the sense of perception, right? That is different from the physical eye. So when you tell me, withdraw the senses, physically it may be easy, right? How do I withdraw my sense of seeing? I can close my eye. Or if you tell me that withdraw the sense of listening, I can go to a quiet place. I can go away from where there is noise or where there's too much music or where there's too much chatting. So I can choose not to see. I can choose to go away to a quiet place. I can choose not to eat certain things in that sense. But controlling the senses also calls for controlling this inner faculty related to the sense organs, isn't it? So how do we do that? So that's the question that Krishna is addressing in this particular shloka. Say for example, there is something before me, right? And I have to not look at it. What will I do? I will turn my head away or I will turn my gaze away. Like I look at something else. If you're standing right in front of me and I don't want to look at you, I'll look sideways or I'll turn behind, right? Now if I have to turn my vision inward, then I have to turn away from the outside world and turn within. And I'm talking of this physically. How do I physically turn within and look at myself and not look at anything outside? Chakshuhu cha eva. And even the eyes or the gaze, antare bhruvo. Antare bhruvoho. Bhruvoho means the eyebrows. And antare is in between. So Krishna is saying here, turn your gaze to the point between the eyebrows. And this is one of the ancient techniques in meditation. You will find it in different types of meditation techniques and processes. Because there are many other reasons why it is suggested we concentrate on that point. It is also the what is referred to as the Agnya Chakra, the place where the third eye or the eye of wisdom is supposed to be located. And it is very important in the pranic system, the Agnya Chakra itself and so on and so forth. But we can also see the practical idea behind it. You know, when I want to turn my gaze away from everything that is in front of me, how do I do it? I actually concentrating on that point between the two eyebrows is like me shutting out everything that is in front of me. I'm trying to turn my senses of seeing inward, and in the process, I am attaching it to this physical practice of trying to concentrate on that point between the eyebrows. And the only way to do that is to not let the eyes see what is before it. In fact, in some of the meditation techniques, they even suggest keeping the eye open or half open and try to look at this point. So this is a meditation technique of how to cut off the eyes from the outside world. Now what about the ears or the faculty of hearing? I can go away to a quiet place. That way the physical ear is free from listening to sounds outside. So what about the inner noises? So the technique suggested for that is listening to one's own breathing. Now this again is a technique in meditation, and Swami has himself spoken about it extensively. This is a very important technique in the meditation techniques in that fall under Buddhism and Zen practices and mindfulness and all of that, right? So Swami would say, concentrate on breath and listen to the sound. And Swami would so beautifully in his discourses, he would say, so hum. But when you listen to this soham, we tend to think that we have to chant soham when we are inhaling and exhaling. And in fact, it is actually quite difficult, even if you try it out right now. Because it is not quite easy to chant so, even as you're inhaling. It is easy to say so, because so is, you have to push air outside of your mouth. So you cannot chant soham inhaling and exhaling. But it is more like listening to the breath. When you are inhaling and exhaling, you imagine that the sound that it is making is soham, right? And this is one of the simple techniques of turning the faculty of listening inward, right? You are just like how instead of seeing outside, I am using my eyes to see at a point which is probably in this body itself, the point between the two eyebrows. In a way, it is like turning away from the outside and looking at inside. Similarly, the turning the faculty of hearing inside is instead of hearing the sounds outside or instead of listening to the chatter in our own brain, we are making it listen to this breath of slowly breathing and inhaling and exhaling. And that is what Krishna mentions, that technique is being mentioned here. Pranapanav, the exhalation and inhalation, nasa abhyantara charinav, that is moving inside the nostrils, samau krithva, make them equal or make them rhythmic. And this again is, you will notice this, when you listen to the breathing, the inhalation and exhalation, even now if you just stop for a moment and you just imagine yourself closing your eye and listening to your breathing even as it is happening, you will notice that automatically that breathing becomes more deliberate and more rhythmic, right? This also is a very time-tested meditation technique. And this is what Krishna doesn't say, that listen to your breath. He says that one who makes this rhythm, breathing rhythmic, he says, prana pano nasa abhyantara charinav samau krithva, one who makes this breathing rhythmic. And how do you make it rhythmic? You have to listen to your breathing. You have to concentrate on that breathing. And in fact, a lot of research has been done into this simple technique of concentrating on the inhalation and exhalation process. And today, neuroscientists have come to believe that this technique is very effective. When the breathing becomes slow and rhythmic, they have literally documented this proof that the mind calms down, the mind becomes sharper, the mind is able to concentrate more, right? So that way, if you look at it, these are two techniques that Krishna is hinting at in the process of turning oneself away from the sense object. But it is not the senses, it is not that the senses are not to be used at all, right? That is not the idea that we must, conclusion that we must come to. Without using the senses, there cannot be any karma yoga whatsoever. But the idea is to acknowledge that the senses can drag us into this vortex of kama and krodha, and when it is not required, you use them, you find ways by which they can be turned within, right? That's the whole idea of this process. This is still only a technique or a concentration, and it may be sharpening our inner faculties. That is why you have such mindfulness being taught even in corporate training and universities and so on, right? Because these are techniques, and techniques can be used by anyone. But for a mumukshu or a karma yogi, it cannot stop at merely being a technique. That is why Krishna continues in the next shloka. He says, yataha indriya manobuddhihi, one who has the senses, mind and intellect controlled, moksha parayanaha, having liberation as his or her supreme goal. It is not enough that through these techniques, if the senses are controlled and the mind is focused, for what are we doing this? What is the purpose for which we are doing this technique and we are controlling the mind? After doing this, if I pursue worldly learning and worldly education, probably I will do it better. I will be good at it and I will be better at it than I was otherwise, right? That's why meditation techniques are universally marketable, right? Because everybody will benefit out of it, whether it's a student, whether it's a businessman, whether it's an artist, or it's a normal person who's, you know, a regular person who's going for a regular job. Everybody benefits by doing meditation, right? But the point is, what am I using it for? That is the question. In fact, there's a very beautiful episode from the life of Swami Vivekananda where when he had been to Chicago, when he had participated in the conference there and all that, he was once walking down the banks of a river where he found a few youngsters trying to shoot, I think, eggshells that were floating along the river. So they had a air gun or something and they were trying to shoot. They were taking a aim at the eggshells and they were trying to shoot, and none of them were able to hit it because the water was undulating and it was flowing. So Vivekananda was standing there and looking at this for a long time, and one of the boys turns to Swamiji and he says, would you like to take a shot? And he says, yeah, why not? And he comes there and I don't know exactly how many rounds he fires, maybe 10 or 12, but he shoots every time the target in those fires, that in those shots that he takes. And these people are so surprised and they say that, are you an expert and have you learned how to shoot the gun? And Swami Vivekananda says, no, this is the first time I'm firing bullets off a gun. And they're surprised and they say, how is it possible? How are you able to do this? Then he says, I have not learned how to fire a gun, but I've learned how to concentrate. I've learned how to focus my mind, right? Because the idea is that if you've learned this technique of trying to yata indriya mano buddhihi, controlling and marshalling the forces of the mind and the intellect, you can do anything, because for everything you need the same things. You need the same mind, you need the same intellect, you need the same senses, right? But the question is, what are you doing it for? So these are only techniques. So apart from being a person who has the senses, mind and intellect controlled, yatendriya mano buddhihi, one should also be a moksha parayanaha, one who has liberation as the supreme goal. Your goal must not be worldly. You must aim beyond the pleasures of this world. Then such a person will be a munihi, a sage. And then Krishna goes on to say, vigata Icha bhaya krodaha, one who has mastered icha, desire, bhaya, fear, and krodaha, anger. Only when we really value something higher, we will not value the pleasures and attainments of the world, isn't it? So when they no more are valuable to us, they cannot cause icha, bhaya, and krodaha, desire, fear, or losing it, or that agitation that comes from desire. So then Krishna concludes by saying, yaha sada mukta eva saha. Such a person is a sadha mukta, ever free. So very beautifully in this shloka, as I said, Krishna is giving practical techniques by which the senses can be turned inward. And these are techniques which are used in meditation, and I'm sure some of us might already be using these techniques, because Swami has also spoken about them extensively, about concentrating on the breath, about focusing on that point between the eyebrows. So these are all techniques, but all along with all of this, there should always be this desire that you may or may not be thinking of moksha as the ultimate and be craving for that in that sense. But there is something more to life than the pleasures that the senses offer. That acknowledgement and that desire that is born out of that acknowledgement that I want something more, something higher, should be driving us, right? And for those who still probably don't have that craving for moksha, mumukshu, we don't have that craving for moksha of that liberation, of the liberated state, the final verse of this chapter is going to refer to that. And it is very, very beautiful that Krishna ends this chapter with this note. So we will listen to verse number 29, the last verse of the fifth chapter, and We'll discuss about that and we'll conclude this episode with that.
Bhoktaram yajna tapasam sarvaloka maheshwaram suhrudam sarvabhutanam jnatva mam shanti mrichhati.
One attains peace by knowing me, who has the great lord of all the worlds, am the enjoyer of sacrifices and austerities, and who am the friend of all creatures. So Krishna ends this chapter by again speaking and declaring himself as Ishvara. In fact, he clearly states, Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, the supreme Ishvara of all the worlds. And why does he all of a sudden bring himself in? As I said, take a look at the state we all are in. We all have desires. Because of desires, we are prone to disappointments. And it is not easy to see beyond our needs at this point in time for many of us. You know, many of us might be in that state. And we had also spoken about doing actions as karma yoga. And for that ability to do actions as karma yoga, we need two attitudes. Ishvara Arpana Buddhi and Prasada Buddhi. So this idea that there is God whom I can worship, whom I can please with my actions, and more importantly, whom I can attain, or at least attaining who becomes a larger purpose to one's life than the worldly pleasures, right? This becomes very important even for the process of karma yoga. As I mentioned before, the Gita is a text that brings all these parts together. That of karma, which of course is obvious. That of jnana, the whole purpose is to attain it. And that of upasana or bhakti, where a path of sweetness is made accessible to everyone, right? So far we saw that Krishna is describing a jnani through the means of sannyasa and karma yoga. And why was he doing that? So that it makes it easy for the sadhaka. When he says that the jnani controls the senses, the jnani does this, the jnani does that. As we have been saying all again and again, these are all hints that Krishna is dropping for the karma yogi and the sadhaka. That you can act like this and you can reach that state. Krishna states here, Bhoktaram yajna tapasam. Bhokta means the enjoyer. Bhoktaram yajna tapasam jnatva mam. It means knowing me, jnatva mam. Knowing me as the enjoyer of the yajnas and tapas. Yajna tapasam. Yajna tapasam is used in general for all sadhanas, because all sadhanas are in some form or the other a way of sacrifice, a way of tapas. So a devotee does not do sadhana for one's own sake, right? In fact, the devotee does not do it for the Lord's sake too. The goal of sadhana is the Lord. I worship Swami, I sing bhajans, I do seva, I do whatever I do as my offering to Swami so that it will earn me that proximity of Swami, so that I can attain Swami, so that you know, Swami will manifest in my life or whatever is that desire. So in that sense, I remove myself from the status of the enjoyer or bhokta of the yajna and tapas that I do. I hope I'm making myself clear here. When I'm doing all of this sadhana, I have a purpose that I want to attain. So my eye or my ambition is fixed on that focus. It could be I want to go closer to Swami, I want to have communion with Swami, whatever it is. So I have placed my purpose on something that is higher. By doing that, I am no more the enjoyer of the sadhana that I am doing. So I am no more the bhokta of the yajna tapas that I am doing. Isn't this the fundamental principle of devotion itself? From doing what I want, I shift to doing what I think pleases Swami. Even if it is an incomplete idea I have of what pleases Swami, right? I don't know Swami and I don't know his likes and dislikes completely. But still, if I sincerely start feeling, I think Swami likes things to be done in this way, so I will follow it. you are not letting your mind be a slave to your raga and dvesha, isn't it? Something which Krishna had mentioned a couple of chapters ago. You're not letting your mind sway to your raga and dvesha. So don't consider yourself as the enjoyer of your actions. Consider God as the enjoyer of your actions. Then whatever you do becomes a sadhana. When I consider myself to be the bhokta, I will try to do things according to my liking. When I consider God, when I consider Swami to be the bhokta, then I will automatically do things according to Swami's liking, right? And many, many episodes like this in Swami's life, when Swami would go to a devotee's house, they would make very bland food and Swami would say that, you know, don't you know that I like spicy food? Swami is beyond likes and dislikes. Swami, in fact, had absolutely no interest in food whatsoever. But when Swami would say that I like spicy food, it is like, it is a very simple act by which you know, when I'm offering something to Swami, it has to be to Swami's liking. It should not be to my liking. I might like sweets, but if Swami likes it spicy, I will make it spicy. So, because he's the one whom I want to ensure that he enjoys what I'm making, right? And that is the essence of devotion itself. It's the fundamental bedrock principle of devotion. That when I do whatever I do as my offering to God, I make him the bhukta. I make him the enjoyer of my actions. Automatically, my actions should become enjoyable to him. So my likes and dislikes, my raga and dvesha does not matter. What he likes becomes more important to me. So Krishna says, bhuktaram yajna tapasam nyatva mam. He who sees me as the enjoyer of all tapas and offerings, sarvaloka maheshwaram. We saw that as the Lord of the whole world, right? Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, it means the words Nyatva Mam comes only once in the shloka towards the end, but it is like Krishna saying that whoever knows me as this, whoever knows me as that, whoever knows me as that. So you can accordingly use that word Nyatva Mam. So Krishna then says, Suhridam Sarvabhutanam Nyatva Mam, knowing me as the Suhrid of all beings. It's a very beautiful word, Sukhrit. This is a word that will occur a few times in the Bhagavad Gita. Sukhrit means a friend. A friend who wishes for your welfare, right? Even if there is nothing for that friend to gain from it, he will wish that what is best for you. Such a friend will not say anything to you which will not lead to your own welfare, right? He will not do anything that will harm your interests. So a sadhaka must consider God as a suhrit. What happens when that attitude comes in? Whatever happens in life, we will think that this must be for my own good because it comes from God. That attitude automatically comes when you look at God as suhritam sarvabhutanam. A person with such qualities, whatever Krishna has mentioned so far, shantim mrichati, attains peace. So Krishna ends this chapter as Ishwara. He says as Ishwara and also giving an opportunity for devotees. Swami, I don't know what is moksha. Swami, I don't know what is liberation. I only know to love you, right? I only want to offer whatever I do to you. And here Krishna ends that beautiful chapter by saying that true sannyasa can be attained even through that love. One who says that whatever I'm doing is a yajna tapas that I offer to Swami. And it has to be pleasing to Swami. Swami is saying that yes, even that is a path which will shantim mrichati, will help you attain the supreme peace. Right? But saying that the one who sees me as the recipient of all devotional offerings, as the friend and benefactor of all beings and the supreme Lord, he or she will also attain that supreme peace. So the path may be slightly different, but then the goal and what it does to the individual internally, what it does to the mind, what it does to the intellect is one and the same, right? So that is the basic premise of Vedanta itself. The paths are many, but the goal is one. And that is the speciality of the Bhagavad Gita in that sense. It is indeed a triune pilgrimage, right? It says that it is available for everybody. I'm a very active person. You have karma yoga for you. Swami, I like to sit and concentrate and meditate. Yes, why not? take the path of jnana, take the path of self-inquiry. Or somebody who says that, Swami, I can only love you and I can only love you and all the beings around. So Krishna says, yes, you can do that too. You can reach me through that too. So with that, dear listeners, we'll conclude this week's episode. Thank you for joining me. We complete the fifth chapter with that. And as we have traditionally done in this series, I will try to come up with a summary next time around. We will summarize the fifth chapter before we go to the sixth chapter. I thank you all for your very, very patient listening, and I thank you for your continued love and support. It means a lot. And I join you all in offering this effort at Swami's lotus feet. A short while from now, you will have a segment of the Vahini Satsang by Brother Bishu. That will be the last segment for the today's Thursday Live. Thank you for being with us through the day. I'll meet you all next week at 7:30 p.m. for the next episode and probably the summary of the fifth chapter. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram.